This is the BBC.
This podcast is supported by advertising outside the UK.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Thank you for downloading this episode of In Our Time. For more details about In Our Time and for our terms of use, please go to bbc.co.uk/radio4. I hope you enjoy the programme. Hello. More than 500 years ago, with England still locked into the Wars of the Roses, a merchant called William Caxton set up shop not far from where I am now, in the city of Westminster. Although he was an experienced businessman, Caxton's trade on this occasion was fairly new to him and entirely new to England. He became a printer, and his printing press in Westminster in 1476 was the first in the country. It was a good 20 years since Johannes Gutenberg in Germany had developed a printing technology, and his invention had already spread to other countries in Europe, to Italy, France and Belgium. But Caxton was the first to bring the phenomenon of print to these shores. He was also the first to print a book in English, The Canterbury Tales, a work that's never been out of print since. But what impact did the printing press have on the production of books, on literary taste, on libraries, and on the English language itself? With me to discuss Caxton are Richard Jameson, Professor of the History of the Book at the University of Durham, Julia Boffey, Professor of Medieval Studies in the English Department at Queen Mary University of London, and David Rundle, a member of the History Faculty at the University of Oxford. Richard Jameson, Caxton was middle-aged before he became a printer. In those days, he could have been dead, couldn't he, really? He was in his 40s.
Indeed. We know a little bit about Caxton's life, both from what he tells us in his own prefaces to his work, but in particular because he's quite well documented as a merchant in his earlier life. We can make inferences from this information, and it's likely he was born about the early 1420s, and then he appears in the documentary record by 1438 when he's become a mercer, so a member of the cloth trade, and luxury cloth as well as simpler textiles. And at that stage, he's apprenticed to a certain Robert Large in London. Now, Large was a high-ranking merchant and eventually rose to be Lord Mayor of London, which suggests that Caxton was perhaps from a well-established textile background. That's just an inference. Certainly, by about 1450, he had joined the merchant adventurers, so had become a textile dealer or a dealer abroad and was based in Bruges. And we know something of his financial value at that stage because he is joint surety, appears in documents because he's been involved in underwriting a loan of about £100, which is a massive amount of money. By 1462, we know from the records that he has risen to be governor of the English nation in Bruges.
What does that mean?
Well, It was a very newly established post, and the various nations, the various nationalities involved in trade in Bruges had representatives that were responsible for internal ordering, but also for representing their interests to the Duchy of Burgundy. And in Caxton's case, in addition, he acted as a crown official, and we see him on a couple of occasions negotiating trade relations between Burgundy and England, trying to bring an end to an embargo upon trade, and also dealing with an exchange rate. And he continued in this role until events seemed to have got the better of him.
Before we move on, can you tell us why he was attracted to Bruges?
Well, Bruges was a cosmopolitan centre, a very flourishing commercial centre.
In the 15th century,
In the 15th century. And it was one of the wealthiest cities in the Duchy of Burgundy, and it grew wealthy as a commercial centre, and there were representatives of Italy, of Spain, of Germany there. And although we know that Caxton moved around, it was a premier commercial site and so a logical place to be.
Richard, Julia Buffy said he was getting tired, or he was about to move from Bruges, but let's go slightly back in the story. Can we talk about the beginning of printing in Europe, in Germany?
Yes, well, from what we know, experiments with printing, this is printing with movable type rather than stamping something with a block of type, were going on from about 1435 in Strasbourg and places like that. By the 1450s, Johann Gutenberg had established himself in Mainz on the Rhine in Germany and was experimenting, continuing to do the things that he'd been exploring until then. And from what we know, it was a conjunction of various aspects of the technology of that goes along with printing, primarily being able to make movable type and being able to make this in...
So when you cut it in wood block, which they did before, you got the A in the wood block, and the A was for life.
That's right.
If you got a movable A, you could put
it
in all sorts
of
words along the line, take it out and put it in again.
Exactly.
Very expensive, though.
So to be able to produce type that you can keep, that you can change, that you can set up and then take out and use again, is a real change in the technology. Other developments were going on, like the perfection of a kind of press that would work, developments of the screw press, like you would have with cheese or pressing grapes or something like that, but which works for printing, developments in the manufacture of ink and the kind of alloy you use to make your types with as well. So Gutenberg was presumably exploring all these things, and by about 1455 had perfected things sufficiently to be able to produce his wonderful Bible.
It's fascinating how technology yet again drives culture again and again. It drives and defines it. One of the things, perhaps we can, for a moment, is paper. The cheapness and abundance of paper was available at this time.
Yes, that's another development that seems to have gone along with all these other things that Gutenberg was able to cash in on, as
now,
it were.
Sorry, Richard's talked about Caxton as a very important man in Bruges, as far as English is concerned, and he became a wealthy man, he was successful. Why did he become interested in this fugitive new technology existing somewhere else in Germany?
I don't think it was as fugitive as all that. It had spread down the Rhine from Mainz. Other printers had established themselves in other centres. Printing had established itself in Strasbourg. By the 1460s, Caxton had probably heard about printing in the Low Countries as well. We know that a couple of copies, I think, of the Gutenberg Bible made their way to London fairly early fairly soon after it was printed, and were decorated in London, interestingly, for people who wanted a kind of amalgam of printing technology and manuscript enhancement of that. So Caxton would have heard about it. He was moving in circles where people bought expensive books in Bruges. It would have been something in the air, I think, and he might have decided that this was both an interesting cultural development and also a great commercial opportunity.
Was there evidence at that time, because we have many examples of printers going bankrupt, was there evidence at that time that printers were making the sort of money he was used to making? He was a substantial figure, Caxton, wasn't he?
I don't really know. I think what you say about printers going bankrupt and printers moving around seems to continue in the next few decades of printing, really. So I that's perhaps hard to answer. But I would imagine someone with a sort of far-sighted view of where things might go and where they might be able to develop a business, where they might be able to make a change to some kind of work that they were interested in and committed to.
So he went to Cologne to investigate this new phenomenon,
yes.
Comparatively new.
Well, he went to Cologne anyway.
Yeah, went to Cologne. Do we know what decided him that this is where he would put his energies? He was in his early 40s, as I mentioned rather casually, perhaps too casually earlier. That was about the life expectation of people at that time. And he was taking on something new and difficult and so on.
We know that things were difficult in England at this time, and we know that he'd ceased to be governor of the English nation in Bruges. Someone else had taken over, John Pickering, I think, another mercer. So perhaps he was thinking to himself, I need a new direction, I need to go somewhere else. He went to Cologne, he found Veldener, Johann Veldener, who was a punch cutter or type founder, who was able to supply types. He was able to work with these people, see what they were up to, see the kinds of books they produced, and, as far as we know, produced some books himself in Cologne. In 1496, I think it is, Wynkyn de Worde, who was one of Caxton's successors and took over his business, talked in one of the books he produced about Caxton having printed a volume of Bartholomaeus Anglicus in Cologne early in his life. So this sounds as if what Caxton was up to in Cologne was having a go at producing books there.
When we say printed, before I move on, do we know that Caxton got down to it himself? Did he move the print around? Was he in the at the sharp end? Or did he say to these chaps, will you do this for me, please, and I'll pay you good money?
I guess he must have known what went on with it, but I guess he had compositors who did the the labour for him. There would be other people doing that and doing the handiwork, as it were.
David Rundle, Caxton established his first print shop in Bruges in the early 1470s, so he went back to Bruges. What was his? Did he have a business plan at this point?
First of all, it may be Bruges, but it may also be Ghent. Recent research suggests that he may not have gone back to Bruges, but to Ghent. And that in itself might be interesting.
This is later research, which has not reached my notes. It's that late.
Yeah, it's that recent. Exactly.
Yes,
just the other day. It is usually said that he went back to Bruges, which would be an obvious place for what he's doing. What Julia just said about what was produced in Cologne, these were Latin books for an international audience. Two of the texts were by Englishmen, but they were Latin texts which could circulate widely. When he gets to Bruges, he's concentrating more on French texts, but also on English texts. So texts which would not have an interest on the continent and would only be for an English market back in London.
Did French have a circulation akin to, if not as big as, Latin at that time?
More localised, but international. And certainly, yeah, French was a language of England still. So in that sense, the books that he's producing in French could be for an English market as well as for a French or for a Low Countries market. The English books are the exception to this. Those are the ones which could only have been of interest to English people on the continent, or more likely to English men and women back in England. What's interesting there is, why do it in Bruges? Why not go straight, or in Ghent? Why not go straight over and set a printing press in England? But of course, as Richard has said previously, Bruges is an international centre. It's a significant centre with good communication routes to England. Effectively, the channel there is not a barrier, it's a route, it's a connection. And so there's a sense in which you can get to that market quite easily while still being on the continent, and so also with some of the other works, getting to an international audience.
Richard, at the beginning of the programme, referred to the wealthy connections that Caxton seems to have had. The person he was apprenticed to became Lord Mayor of London, and so on and so forth. We learned that he had an association with Margaret of York, from Burgundy, and how did he set about getting that patronage, and how important was it to him?
He does have patronage from Margaret of York, who becomes the wife of Charles the Bold and then the Duchess of Burgundy. Yeah, and he mentioned this in his first English printed book, The History of Troy. He mentions there that he'd been translating this for years. It sounds as if it's a sort of a hobby he'd had to sit down and translate it. He gave up on it. Then he says he showed it to the Duchess.
What was the phrase he used? To dispel idleness.
Which in itself is actually a trope. Often, if people are writing a book, they're saying they're doing this to avoid being idle. And actually, what he says in that preface is full of tropes, is full of expressions that you find in so many other places, which can make us slightly suspicious of it. So he says he presented it to Margaret. Margaret looked at it and said, no, you have to change that. That's not quite right. And go on and finish it. And he claims that he's writing it because she commanded him to finish it. He also says there...
Listeners what this book is. I mean, it's the stories of those who escaped from Troy, and it was thought like Aeneid came to Europe and Western Europe and set up the greatness of Europe as it was then beginning to think itself.
Exactly. And this is a French version of those stories, which he's translating into English.
Very popular.
The romances of Troy are very popular generally. Yeah, what's interesting in this particular case, of course, is that he's choosing to translate from French into English. Whether he is getting a pension from Margaret of York, but whether it's actually specifically to assist him in doing this work, and whether there's some sense in which there's patronage for this book, whether it's a commission, that's more open to question. Now, too often we can read prefaces ingenuously and imagine that they do demonstrate a strong connection with a supposed patron.
One of the distinguishing factors about Caxton are the number of his prefaces to books. So we know quite a lot about him and the business trade, whatever you want to call it, from his prefaces. Back to you, Richard Gameson. How technically complex was the printing process in the 15th century?
Well, perhaps if I just outline the elements of it and then comment on what this implied for bookmaking. As we've heard earlier on, the key thing was the making of the movable type. So you had to design your type, cut it in reverse, set it. When you were a compositor, you were setting the text in reverse, first of all in little composing sticks, and then transferring it to the bed of the printing press proper. And at that stage, you might readjust it to give a more agreeable outline, so justification. Then, of course, the paper is laid down on a frame, then it's pressed. And that's repeated 300 times for each individual page. If we think about the implications of that process, well, in the first case, it's very expensive up front. So the materials you need, the press, the type, that's a lot of money. And whereas in the old manuscript age, one scribe copying one book is fairly cheap, you had to have a lot of capital up front to print. Secondly, one of the myths is that printing is more accurate than copying by hand in manuscripts. But what we have to remember is it is still a human being copying from a manuscript in type, and he's doing it back to front and upside down. So you end up...
I've got a trivial thing going through my head. The Ginger Rogers said she did everything Fred Astaire did, except she did it backwards on high heels. Now, where did that come from?
And
no,
so...
compositors in high heels.
Well, we don't know.
And so you have 300 copies that are identical, but not necessarily more accurate. And the other thing is, as a printer or as a publisher, and we might think of Caxton as a publisher, you had to be very clear about how many copies you were going to print and make an informed estimate, because as you printed each page, you took the print apart, so you couldn't then run on if it sold well. And if you estimated too many, you were left with stock and went bankrupt. If you estimated too few, you didn't maximise your profit.
He seems to have been, we'll come to that, he seems to have been far better than most at that, doesn't he? But we'll go into that, I hope, later. Julie Boffy, the big move, he moves his print business from Bruges to London to Westminster, a breezy quarter of an hour walk from here. What was his motivation for doing that?
To try the English market, obviously, as David suggested, but the move...
Did he bring the presses over in a boat? I mean, did he put these great lumpen stuffs in?
Yeah. He must have somehow had them brought over and installed himself. The really interesting decision is Westminster, I think, because everyone thinks of Caxton and they think, oh, London and printing, but it's actually Westminster, which is outside the city of London. And he perhaps was thinking, there's Westminster Abbey, there's a Benedictine foundation there. There's all the business that will go with that.
Printing indulgences and,
yes, and we know
lives of saints and all that stuff that he did.
All that kind of stuff. Yeah. We know that Benedictines had been very deeply involved in printing on the continent and continued to be. He's got the seat of government, as it were. There's all the trade going on that's coming out of Westminster Hall there, but he's still not in the city of London. So it's quite an interesting decision to set himself up there.
Does he lose by not being in the city, Julia?
I don't think he does at that stage. It's interesting that later printers do move themselves into the city by 1500.
Is there also an element that he is therefore outside any guild restrictions on scribes and traditional bookmaking within the old city of London?
I mean, he gets out of the way of the unions.
Exactly.
Yes.
And equally, if he is importing significant quantities of books. It gives him more freedom, again, from trade regulations by being based outside the restrictions of the City of London.
Yes.
There's also another factor, isn't there, which is that around Westminster Abbey, just like around St Paul's, is a book trade centre already. Yeah, and so there are bookstalls with books, including imported printed books, being sold in the City of Westminster as well as in the City of London. So in that sense, actually, it's a centre already.
Yes, so it's a sort of double market. Yeah. Well, we know he advertised in the city. We know he printed advertisements that got pinned up. So he clearly had different ways of distributing what he printed.
So he's advertising the back of his own books. David Rundle, can we go into the books he produced in London?
Absolutely. Yeah, obviously what we remember are mainly the books that he produces in English. For those, he's looking back generations to Chaucer, who he is involved in the process of establishing as the father of the English language.
Can you just pause for a moment there? How is he establishing it? Chaucer was very well known in manuscript form. There are many manuscript versions of the Canterbury Tales. So what did Caxton do to, as several of you said, only three of you, well, still three, several, I suppose, said, has to establish Chaucer as the father of English literature? What did printing do to make that a reality?
It may not be what printing does, but it's that he, in print, is doing what other scribes could have done earlier, adding to that, though, by the fact of by his prefaces or his epilogues. In one example, Chaucer's translation of Boethius' Consolation of Philosophy, he adds at the end a comment about Chaucer's tomb in Westminster Abbey, just next to where he is, and adds also a Latin epitaph to him written by humanist Stefano Surigoni, and that's produced on the last page. Again, there was a sense there that he's recognising the position that Chaucer already has, but building on it. So he's not creating he's not creating the reputation of Chaucer. He's building on that reputation.
So we have that. Can we develop the Canterbury Tales? There's much more to say there. He did it. It was a success.
It's one of the cases where he produces.
I don't want to be Caxton Canterbury Tales programme.
No.
He did a lot more, but still a bit more on Canterbury Tales.
Yes, it's an interesting case where we have a second edition where there's no preface in the first edition, but there is in the second. And this tells us a rather interesting story. It shows Caxton's admiration for Chaucer and then explains that after he'd done his first edition, soon after arriving in Westminster, one of the purchasers, a gentleman, and he's always concerned to stress the credentials of his purchasers, compared it with a manuscript and found certain discrepancies, went back to William Caxton, so Caxton tells us, and said, well, my father, in fact, has the best available manuscript of Chaucer's works. If you will agree to print a second edition, then I'll let you do it from this manuscript. We do have that second edition, and there are minor changes, but they are fairly minor ones in terms of the text, a bit of reordering and so on. The most important change in the second edition is that it adds a series of woodcuts, images of the pilgrims themselves, and is a much more visually attractive volume. So do we actually believe this story? There might be some truth in it, but it's almost certainly a marketing ploy and goes back to the point I was making earlier. Clearly, Caxton had printed, let us say, 300 copies of the first edition, knew he could sell more, but needs to do something new to ensure that the second edition of 1483 will sell to a broad market, including some of the original purchasers. Adding illustrations and saying this text is the text is an interesting way of marketing it.
David.
I was just going to say, making it new, but also making it closer to manuscripts. Because manuscripts, of course, have a tradition of images of the pilgrims, where the problem with printed books is that usually they're more monochrome, and actually adding in something like this brings it back closer to manuscript culture.
Julia?
I think
Julia
it's interesting. It's interesting to see Caxton being effectively an editor as well here, and you can see this in other works. And to move to another of Chaucer's poems, The House of Fame, is left by Chaucer in manuscript unfinished for whatever reason, or perhaps he ends it at a point that makes it seem unfinished. Caxton comes along and supplies an ending in his copy and writes Caxton next to it. So he can interpose himself into these things.
Julia, can you, and then you, the other two chip in. Can we give the listeners an idea of the range of his publication? Canterbury Tales, he got there in one, just like he got there with the Trojans. He obviously had an eye for what was popular and classy at the same time and developed that. So he was, and he was a man of substance in terms of his thought. But a lot, he published a lot else. So can you just go across quickly the waterfront of what he published? He published 110 books after all, and away we go.
We can start on this and all.
There's the sort of translations in from the French, the great Burgundian literature. There's the English literature. We shouldn't overlook the fact that he did Latin service books as well, books of hours.
English literature, we're talking about Gower, we're talking about
Gower, John Lydgate, but also more recent. Anthony Woodville, Earl Rivers, brother to Edward IV's wife, publishes his translations, but the Latin service books, as you say.
And although they were always a part of his work, they were surely a bigger part than is now represented, because we've just lost copies at the Reformation. And then in addition, he also did what we might class as books of manners, morals, to improve your life. I mean, there's a rather nice one called Stans Puerit at Mensam, which is about manners for the youth. Mm. And there's the Book of the Knight of the Tower, which is addressed more to young ladies than young men.
One called Little John, or the Book of Courtesy as well, which I rather like. The other point, I think, is that he printed histories.
Yeah.
The market for histories is huge. There's a prose history of Britain called The Brute, which exists in numerous manuscript copies. We know that was very popular. And Caxton printed that in 1480 and added something of his own, which brought it further up to date. And then the Polychronicon, a world history as well, which he printed in 1482.
But David Rundle.
I'm just thinking, but we mustn't also forget the small printings. Melvin, you mentioned indulgences earlier. He's doing that sort of broadsheet publishing, and he's also doing small publications which are commissions, it seems. But also we might think about what he's not doing. If you look at his the people who become his competitors, or the other publishers, John Letoo in London, Theodoric Rood in Oxford for a while, then Richard Pinson, his emphasis on English. Caxton's emphasis in English is very unusual, but it also there's a lack of... there are very few school texts, and there are very few legal texts, and those are big markets for printed books.
Richard, can I... say what you want to say, and then
I was simply going to say that that's absolutely right, and we have to remember that what Caxton is printing is fitting into what he knows can be imported. And this is against a background of large imports from the continent of high-status Latin texts that can be used in universities. And he's positioning himself within the market to fill what he can perceive as gaps.
But he's bringing that in. He's playing all ends. And that's the interesting thing about him. I don't mean in any cynical way. He's importing books, he's exporting books, he's printing books, he's reprinting books. He's also doing things. He's sort of setting the template for what will become the move forward in English literature. For instance, this is from your notes, so there you go. Maud D'Arthur, the manuscript didn't turn up until 20th century, but he has printed it, and so we have the printed version, and the idea of Maud D'Arthur, which travelled right through the centuries, we can say is due to his nose for publishing as well as printing.
That's right, and he would identify that as the sort of courtly romance literature that had been so successful in translations from the French, and is a new text. And what is the advantage for someone like Caxton? If he has a new text that nobody else has access to, he has a monopoly on it. And we can look at his spread of works and those that he particularly translated and favoured publishing, and they're things that, on the whole, he would have as a monopoly.
Did the cheapness, David Rundle, as it might seem, of the printed book impinge on buyers of books immediately?
Before Caxton arrives, books are being imported into England before Caxton sets up his printing press, and continues throughout the 15th, 16th century. England is effectively, in terms of printing, a backwater, despite Caxton, Pinson, all the others. Lots of text would need to be imported. But the key advantage, of course, for importing, for movement, is that they are light. They can be shipped in barrels, several copies together. They'll be moving unbound. The fact that they're on paper rather than parchment, as manuscripts were often, would have made them light, and therefore also cheaper. The impact of that is that actually the concept of what is an acceptable library in terms of numbers of books multiplies.
That's an interesting footnote, isn't it? The way that the actual physical library changed. Which one of you wants to say that? Because I found that fascinating. You?
I'm happy to talk about that. I mean, the physical library changes. If you think of a library room, the 15th century library would usually be a rectangular room with a series of lecterns with the books placed underneath. When you get... And a large library... several hundred books. When you get into print, several thousand books. Two impacts. First of all, they throw out some of the old books because they're old. And so we're losing manuscripts because of that, even though manuscripts continue to be made alongside this. But secondly, they have to redesign the library. And what they do is actually disastrous for the light in the library because they build up above the lecterns to make slots.
And there are a couple of other factors here. One is that people are aware of books being shelved upright on their shelves, and that only really becomes feasible, the way we store books, once you've moved over to paper as the body of the book. Most books in parchment will be stored flat in some sense, lying on lectern or stored flat.
But this cheapness, I mean, quite soon afterwards, when Tyndall's getting the New Testament coming to this country in the 1520s, which is very soon afterwards, we're getting loads coming in terms of 6,000 copies are coming over, and it becomes unstoppable and challenges the English state as well as the then English consensus of religion. So the mass of stuff that is now enabled by printing has an enormous effect on history as well as culture and...
A comment there is that this is the world in which Caxton is increasingly competing, and we know that when he is trying to find his niche for English books, that in fact some of his contemporaries are importing thousands of books. We have a chap, Peter of Savoy, who during Caxton's lifetime imports over 1,000 books, and that's just what we can see from the records themselves.
Julia Bovey, can we go into this rather... intricate subject. Well, not intricate, but a bit tricky. Scholars have attributed the standardisation, the beginnings of the standardisation of the English language, this in part to Caxton and his publications. Would you go along with that?
I don't think so entirely, no. Caxton has quite a lot to say about the English language. He talks about the kind of English he uses and the kind of English he finds in the texts he prints. He characterises himself as someone rude and unlearned. He's very good at talking about himself in this way, and it's a trope, as David's talked about other kinds of tropes that he used.
It's kind of vain modesty, really.
Yes. Yeah. He says, at the beginning of his edition of the Polychronicon, this translated world history, Caxton didn't translate it, but he inherited the translation from John Trevisa, who'd made it in the 14th century, he says, "I find the English a bit rude and old in this book, so I'm going to change it in my printed edition." But what he does is by no means consistent or standard. He changes a few words here and there, but he doesn't engage in any kind of scholarly programme of updating this thing.
What about spelling?
Well, there's an element with spelling whereby it could be subservient to typesetting, because to start with, Caxton doesn't even attempt to justify lines, or at least his workshop doesn't.
What do you mean by that?
So we're used to text which left and right hand margin are straight lines.
Right.
He doesn't, his workshop doesn't until about the 1480s attempt to do this. But one of the devices you could use for justification for making lines longer was adding an extra E or an extra S in the middle of the word. So whereas on the one hand you've got 300 copies...
So a lot of our E's and S's and Q's and U's come from filling up the line.
Your typesetter could decide to add in extra letters, put an E at the end of Queen or not, if it would be useful to justify the line itself.
Oh, this is the sort of scholarship we're all interested in, Richard.
But there is another point here, which, of course, is there are not many rivals to what he does. Certainly not many rivals outside the southeast. And this is quite interesting.
Yeah.
In the spread of printing in England, it contrasts to France, say, particularly to Germany, for understandable reasons. But you don't have, in the 15th century... Well, in the 15th century, you have Westminster, London, Oxford, St Albans. And those are the four places. You're not moving very far. Now, obviously, not all of that only a minority overall of that is in English anyway. But you're not getting the other other varieties being printed.
So what happens, it seems to me, from what you've written, is that Caxton, let's take Canterbury Tales and the other, in the southeast, and as you said, just around the southeast, is establishing something, and the written word is beginning to become, I agree with you, it takes a while, beginning to be standardised in this area. So we say English is standardised, but it's written English, because spoken English is still as varied and as various up to the First World War, really.
Yes.
And in a way, the distinction here is that if you're printing books in 300 copies, to survive, you need not just to sell to your immediate audience, but to ship them around the country. And so whereas 100 years earlier, a scribe, let us say in Durham, might have copied a manuscript imposing his own spelling, we know that the monks of Durham were buying books that had come in to Oxford or from London itself. So that version of the spelling unchanged is now being used in quite different locations.
Did Caxton have a view of the currents of thought? Let's take humanism, the attempt to bring classical learning into play of European culture and science. So did he have any sense that that was going on and try to respond to it, encourage it, be part of it?
This is a really interesting question because, of course, sometimes we would connect the printing press with new learning as a Renaissance development. Indeed, from Francis Bacon onwards, we think of it in those terms. But it's not necessarily a friend of humanism, generally. And actually, the point that Richard said at the very beginning about the problems you can have with a text. This is when printed, that it can be printed wrongly, and then it becomes very dangerous. That's the point that humanists make. They use the printing press, but they're also concerned about it. In terms of Caxton in particular, it's often said that actually he's using it in the interests of medieval culture, not Renaissance culture, a terrible dichotomy which we shouldn't really use at all. And there are some examples of his connection with Italian humanists who are working in England. I mentioned Suigone earlier, but there are also Pietro Camilliano, who's really significant as a secretary to Henry VII. There's also, he prints a work by Lorenzo Traversani, who is the first person to teach humanist eloquence in Cambridge. But also with Englishmen associated with humanism, like John Russell, Bishop of Lincoln, and all the more important, John Tiptoff, Earl of Worcester, who was for some time Constable of England and got the friendly nickname of the Butcher of England for his exercises killing people off in that role. But in those cases, the question would be how far he's connecting to them as humanists, or how far is he connecting to them because of their existence and for other reasons. And it seems, in particularly with people like Tiptoff and John Russell, it's not to the humanist interest.
Julia Boffy, manuscript, the production of manuscripts didn't just cease. It took a long, it went on. Was there can you tell us how long it went on and how powerful it remained? For how long, sorry, lots of questions. And also, were people around saying, oh, it'll never catch on, this technology. And I've got this bloke who copies things out for me just down the road. It's much cheaper and he can do it in a month and get anything I want out of him. Is that going on as well?
I think that is going on. And manuscript production continues for centuries for particular purposes. And it's all too easy to forget this. Scribes who at first might have seemed worried that they were going to be out of jobs weren't out of jobs because plenty of things needed to be copied by hand still.
Richard's already said that manuscripts could be much more accurate.
Yes, and manuscripts could also be much more beautiful. If you wanted to give someone a present, you might well give them a beautifully produced manuscript.
And that's key. That's key. Patronage isn't served well by printed books. If you want to impress a potential patron, something produced in black and white without any pictures is not really the way to do it. And what's interesting is both that scholars like Erasmus will use manuscripts, or they'll have painted copies, they'll have illuminated copies of their their printed
books. And the other issue there is, of course, you can't always get the printed book when you want it. You remember that they're produced in runs, then they go out of print. But a scribe never goes out of print, so if you wanted a particular text that was out of print, you had the printed text copied by a scribe.
Yeah, but let's not forget that the deluge was the printed book it came through. I mentioned Tyndall, but others like it, they're coming through in their thousands.
It was, but the thing that finally killed off the scribe was not the printed book, it was the typewriter.
Long time, eh?
Yes.
It has a lot to... I knew the typewriter had a lot to answer for. there's a question here that was... I'd like to raise. I wonder if it makes any sense. Because of the development and widespread use and reliance on printing as time went on, did the printed word begin to have a greater authority than the spoken word, or did it reinforce that authority which had been growing for a long time?
No. I think the answer to that must be, look at literacy rates. Most people are going to be getting their information orally. They're not going to be getting it as the written word.
I'm not talking about how people are educated. I'm talking about the authority that they vest in the spoken word vis-a-vis the printed word. It's down there in black and white, as it were, that sort of...
That is an important point, although knowing what is there in black and white is often dependent on people telling you what's there. I suppose we'd also be moving on to Reformation changes and the presence of a Bible in every parish church. Regal authority in particular is not simply expressed through the presence of the written word, but through a set of different coins, etc.
And the written word can still be a manuscript written word, can't it? Thinking of how manuscript retains its currency today, if you get a certificate for something, it's usually been copied by someone, by a calligrapher. Yes. You don't get a printed one. So there's still a distinction there.
And that's very important also, actually, if you think about how diplomatic correspondence occurs. Often it's written, and then the person sending it will write in their own hand, and the fact it's in their own hand matters.
Yes.
You have any comment on this, Richard?
Not at all.
You're passing. Durham is silent. Well, that must say something. Caxton died in 1491. His business went to one of his protégés, Vinken de Verde, who stayed there for a long time, yes, about 30 or 40 years. Again, but after Caxton, it seems the very few Englishmen, Germans and people from other nationalities, are coming to this country to carry on that tradition.
Well, the printing tradition as a whole was mainly... the people who actually operated the presses, who worked it, seem to have been non-native English people. Vinken de Verde, who you mention, we believe that he came from the Low Countries, from a town near modern Gouda, and he was, we believe, Caxton's foreman. He takes up residence in Westminster in about 1479, and he takes over the business in due course. And the change that he...
Does it flourish?
Yes. Well, he first of all seems to print for Caxton's heirs, who are involved in a legal dispute until about 14... for 5 or 6 years after Caxton's death. Then in the 1490s, Vinken de Verde is still printing the sorts of things, on the whole, that Caxton had been doing. But by 1500, 1501, he seems to have had a rethink of the business strategy. And alongside works for an elevated clientele, he's increasingly doing educational works, pamphlets, smaller-scale works. And at that stage, he actually abandons Westminster and moves to the City of London to Fleet Street.
As many of them do.
Indeed.
And so we have that thing going on, and is the Gutenberg gallery... Oh, it isn't time. I've crossed hands in the thing over there, which means I've got half a minute left, which means I've got 30... whatever it is. Thank you very much, all of you. Next time, David Rundle, Richard Gameson and Julie Poppy, thank you very much indeed. Next week we'll be talking about Fermat's Last Theorem. I'm surprised we haven't done it before, but we haven't. That's next week. Thanks for listening.
There are many more Radio 4 arts and discussion programmes to download for free. Find these on the website at bbc.co.uk/radio4.
I'm Helena Bonham Carter, and for BBC Radio 4, this is History's Secret Heroes, a new series of rarely heard tales from World War II.
They had no idea that she was Britain's top female codebreaker.
We'll hear of daring risk-takers.
What she was offering to do was to ski in over the high Carpathian mountains.
Of course it was dangerous, but danger was his friend.
Subscribe to History's Secret Heroes wherever you get your podcasts.